This is John Leo at MindingTheCampus.com. I'm here with Professor Donald Downs of the University of Wisconsin, who specializes in poli-sci journalism and
law.
And law, yes. He's just given a speech here at the Harvard Club in New York, and it's on academic freedom. Don, why should the average listener to this podcast be interested in this subject?
Well, academic freedom matters because it's one of the key ways, not the only way, but one of the key ways that society develops knowledge, learns how to pursue the truth, and so we become more knowledgeable and better critical thinkers and therefore better citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Academic freedom is a professional concept that applies to academic life, so it's not quite the same thing as the regular First Amendment rights. That's something I didn't get into today, but that would have just made it too complicated. So it pertains to academic institutions, and it involves sort of a balance between the right to pursue your truth as you see it, but a responsibility to do so in a way which meets professional standards of scholarship and pedagogy. So
what,
it's a balance between rights and responsibilities.
Sorry, what are some examples of how freedom of speech is different from academic freedom?
Well, if you're a student in a class, and say the class is on geometry, you don't have a right to go in there and just talk about some other subject, you know, like history or political science. Sometimes in classes there's always a little bit of give and take and tangential things come up, but the focus of the class has to be, you know, the subject matter. You have a right to believe that 2 and 2 is 5.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, the Supreme Court once said in a 1974 case that there is no such thing as a false idea under the First Amendment. What that means is that the First Amendment was not going to, you can't be punished by the state for believing a false idea in general. But if you believe that 2 and 2 is 5, good luck getting hired as a mathematics teacher or mathematics professor. If you believe the Earth is flat, good luck getting hired as a geographer or a geologist or astronomer or something like that. So academic freedom is more bounded than freedom of speech because it's tied to the institutional rights and responsibilities, professional standards. But in some ways, it's stronger because if you have tenure. If you don't have tenure, you could be fired from your job for what you believe.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, what are the most salient objections to academic freedom now?
Well, I think that there's a concern that it's abused. Universities, to have academic freedom, you have to be able to make a case for why universities are special institutions. Because you do get tenure in government jobs and even in some private sector jobs if it's part of the contract, but it's certainly not the same kind of presumption that you have with universities. And that means then that universities have to be fulfilling the responsibilities that society gives them in order to justify having academic freedom. And I think some objections are now that universities themselves have compromised academic freedom through speech codes and other kinds of policies that enforce a kind of orthodoxy rather than protecting a diversity of ideas and free speech. So the institutions have forsaken their duty to act responsibly. And in some cases, you get individual professors on the other side that have acted irresponsibly.
Mm-hmm. Well, you with some allies at the University of Wisconsin were very successful in getting rid of the faculty speech code there.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, that was really an interesting thing. Back in the mid to later 80s, universities across the country, and all very quickly, passed speech codes, harassment codes, and various policies designed to, in effect, kind of criminalize within the university context those who say things that are considered offensive or out of line on grounds of race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. And Wisconsin was one of the pioneers in that. And the effect around the country was to make it much more difficult to talk about sensitive subjects involving those topics, even though they were among the most important topics in the country. So there was a real thwarting of the marketplace of ideas on campus and the pursuit of truth in those areas. So we came to conclude at Wisconsin that, especially after we had some cases where the code was applied in a really unconscientious way to people for doing things that should have been clearly within the bounds of freedom of speech and academic freedom, that we were going to mount a movement to get rid of the faculty speech code. We thought about going to court, but we didn't for two reasons. One is the ACLU would not take our case, and we had no money at that time. And two, the ACLU might have been correct because it's not at all clear that the faculty speech code was unconstitutional, because courts have tended to be pretty lenient towards institutions when it comes to these things. They were very intolerant of student speech codes, but much more permissive of faculty speech codes, because faculty are considered like employees of the institution. So we had to fight it the old-fashioned way. We had to take it down on the basis of a political movement. No one thought we could. Wisconsin's a very sort of left-oriented university that was really much into this stuff. Had been a pioneer in speech codes, and yet over a period of years, we were able to galvanize, mobilize a critical core of faculty that raised this as an issue. And then we had some cases come our way that made it salient. And we went to the university senate and raised it as an issue. And after a two-year-long battle, the faculty senate voted to abolish the faculty speech code.
Tell me this, why do universities keep installing speech codes and harassment codes when they know if it gets to federal court, it will be struck down anyway?
Well, sometimes it won't, but even when it will, they have an incentive to do it. There's a guy named John Gould who teaches, he's a lawyer and political scientist at George Mason University, director of their legal studies program there. And he has a book called Speak No Evil, and it's all about college speech codes and their effects. On one hand, he thinks the effect of college speech codes has not been as sinister as people like me think. But he also has a whole analysis of what motivates schools to do these things. He found out after a 1992 Supreme Court decision, RAV versus St. Paul, which undercut the constitutional basis for almost all these speech codes, that the number of speech codes increased after that Supreme Court decision rather than decreased. And he argues that because universities, they have their own internal motivation structures that makes it so that administrators have more to gain by passing these codes than by not passing them. And he argues that a lot of them have no intention of really applying them. It's just symbolic politics, a way to sort of do something for constituencies that are pressuring you. And if you don't apply them, you don't have to alienate anyone who's had it enforced against them. So it's a way of kind of maintaining the status quo and maximizing your response to pressure.
Talk about the Canadian professor who refused to teach his course and wanted activism be taught instead.
Well, there was a professor at the University of Ottawa, who physics professor, first day of class. He informed the class they weren't going to be teaching, he wasn't going to be teaching any physics that year, and that there was going to be a class on political activism, and that all the students would get A's. And the university wasn't very happy about this, and the students weren't happy about it either. I mean, they're paying good money to learn physics.
Sure.
So they told him, well, I'm sorry, you've got to teach physics. That's what you're being paid to do. And he claimed academic freedom. He's going to lose, and he may have already lost. I haven't kept up on that case since I last looked into it a couple months ago. But he has no claim there whatsoever. But that's an example of a obviously specious academic freedom claim by an individual that makes us all look bad.
And say a bit about Cornell. And you were there when the university collapsed in front of armed students.
Well, 1969, students took over the student center with rifles, and they wanted the university to grant certain demands. And because of the fear on campus and a massive student mobilization in favor of these students, the administration and the faculty ended up conceding to their demands. And represented a situation in which faculty, rather than upholding basic principles of order and civility in an institution dedicated to reason, conceded at the in the face of coercion and threats of violence. One of the leaders of the student group said, Cornell has 3 hours to live if the faculty doesn't give in to our demands. So they, by giving in, the faculty in a sense sacrificed core principles of what a university is supposed to be and sort of politicized the university, and that has been a bit of a problem ever since then. And you know, in my I wrote a book on this in 1999. I was critical of the faculty, but in retrospect, I can understand why some of the faculty did vote to give in to the demands because they were concerned about massive violence. That would be, you know, they felt a necessity to do so. But then they should have gone, they should have reacted to that by doing some sort of really potent symbolic protest, like either massively resigning or taking a leave or refusing to teach. You know, they could have organized and made stood up for their principles, even though they felt they had to concede to these demands under the circumstances, but they didn't do that.
Well, in conclusion, I should say that Cornell 1969 is still in print. You can get it from Amazon. And you can get the short version of the 40th anniversary written for Minding the Campus, mindingthecampus.com. Thank you, Donald Downs, for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure, John. Always is.